Okay, welcome to the seminar. We are very grateful that Mary accepted our invitation. Let me start with a short introduction. She studied physics with theoretical physics at the University of Manchester and completed a master's degree in 2021. She did her PhD in experimental particle physics at the University of Edinburgh with the LHCb group, where she was awarded an Institute of Physics IOP Bell Burnell Scholarship and completed in 2025. Now she's a postdoc in the high energy physics group at Cavendish Laboratory and is studying rare particle physics decays with the LHCb detector. Her research focuses on the studies of decays of B mesons into a pair of muons, which allows precise testing of the standard model and sensitivity to beyond the standard model physics. Okay, over to you, and let's welcome.
Thank you very much for the introduction. It's really nice to be back here. I've been here a couple of times before, so it's nice to be here. So I'm going to be talking about charmless B to BB decays, specifically the decays of B sub S and B0 to 5-5. And if you don't know what that means now, hopefully you'll know what it means soon and you'll realise why they're interesting. So I'm going to talk about what these charmless B to BB decays are and why we should care about them, which is going to talk about the standard model and its shortcomings, CP violation in the standard model, and something called polarisation puzzle, which is a bit curious. To do that, I'm then going to talk about the LHCb experiment, which is best suited for studying these types of decays, and then go on to this specific analysis of B sub S and B0 to 5-5, which is measuring CP violation in BS to 5-5 and also performing a search for B0 to 5-5. So this is a recent result. This is what I spent most of my PhD doing. And then I'll wrap up with a bit of status and roadmap. So probably you've seen this diagram before, but the standard model of particle physics describes the fundamental particles, how they interact with one another. And on the whole, it works very well to explain a lot of natural phenomena. And it's been probed in exquisite detail for decades with some of the biggest experiments. But there are still several things it can't explain. Those things are that the universe is made entirely of matter. So we believe, but we also believe that the matter and antimatter were produced in equal amounts. So the question is, where did that antimatter go? And the answer is still something to be understood. Another thing is, what is dark matter? We know that dark matter must be there from things like studying galactic rotation curves. And another thing is neutrinos. Do they have mass, which is not accounted for in the standard model? And are they Majorana particles? Are neutrinos their own antiparticles? So these are some of the big questions in the standard model. And the one that I care about the most is this asymmetry in matter and antimatter. So how is it that we can generate this asymmetry in matter and antimatter? And there are three conditions that were derived by Sakharov. And that we to generate this matter-antimatter asymmetry, we need baryon number violation. We need the violation of charge and charge parity symmetries. And we also need for the universe to move away from thermal equilibrium. So what I'm going to be talking about is how we get CP violation from the standard model. So this is going to be a bit of a scary slide with a matrix on it. But essentially, the CP violation in the standard model comes from this matrix called the CKM matrix, where we have the quark flavor states, so the states of flavor, mix with each other because the mass states and the flavor eigenstates are not the same. So this CKM matrix connects the different quark flavors. So you can see here we've got up, down, charm, strange, top and bottom. Each of these elements is a number that connects. For this, for example, here up to down, which is nearly one. And then this is an approximately diagonal matrix where it's basically one all along here, but we have non-zero contributions here. So you can have swapping between the quark generations. You can go connect up with strange, up with bottom, for example. And that's determined by this matrix. And where we get this charge parity violation in the standard model is that this matrix has the complex phase in it. So we can study this matrix. So it's a unitary matrix. And because it's a unitary matrix, you can write what we call the unitarity relations, which are these sums over these individual elements. And if you write these relations, you can also represent those as triangles in the complex plane. So here I've drawn what is commonly referred to as the CKM triangle, but there are multiple triangles depending on which of these elements you choose. So this one has a PUB, BCD, and VTD, VTB. And then you can see that this is a closed triangle with three angles, alpha, gamma, and beta. So the CP violation that we've measured in the standard model by probing these triangles is currently not enough to explain what we believe the observed dosimetry to be. It's not explained by standard model CP violation. So we want to search for additional sources of CP violation that could be coming from beyond standard model physics. And our goal is to measure these triangles. And if we can over-constrain the standard model parameters, we can look for an inconsistency that might be coming from very high scale new physics that could might affect one mode and not the other. So for example, you might have some new physics that looks something like this. So how do we measure these triangles? This is the triangle that I've drawn before, this what we call the CKM triangle, but then we've got this other triangle that doesn't really look like a triangle, but I promise you that it is. This is what we sort of commonly refer to as the B0 triangle, and then this one on the right is the BS triangle. So this angle beta we can probe by studying decays of B0 mesons to J psi K short. We can get this angle gamma typically in B decays to charm. And then on this BS triangle, we get this angle beta S from decays BS to J psi 5. This is what we call one of our golden modes for LHCb. So BS to J psi 5, okay, so J psi is a charmonium, so charm anti-charm, and a phi is typically S bar. So BS to J psi 5 decays, we can measure this CP violating phase that I'm going to call phi S C C bar S. You're going to understand why I've called it that in a moment. But this relates to the BS triangle that I showed on the previous slide, and this angle beta S, and this is this CP violating phase is minus 2 beta S. Now, roughly where that comes from is if you consider the Feynman diagrams that describe the process. So you have this process of the decay. So this is a decay that happens at what we call tree level, meaning there's no loops in there. And we get at this vertex, we've got a B, an anti-B in an anti-charm. So that's a DCB. At this one, we've got a charm and a strange, so that's BCS. Now, the other thing that you can have in neutral mesons is that they can mix with one another. So in a BS meson, we've got an anti-B quark and an S quark. Now, if you draw this rather complicated looking box diagram, you can end up with an anti-S and a B quark, which is basically the antimatter swap of what we had before. So this is called mixing. So you have a BS changing into a BS bar, and that happens at some frequency. So you have these oscillations of these neutral B mesons. So if you consider these two contributions to this decay happening, you can look at the CKM angles that come into it, so these ones I've highlighted in blue, and work out that the CP violating phase C phi S C C bar S is minus 2 beta S. Now what I'm going to do is I'm going to take that charm away, and now we have, instead of an CC bar, we've got an SS bar, so now we've got two phis. So this is BS phi phi, and this is a decay that can only happen at penguin level. You don't get this tree level contribution. You have to have a loop in there somewhere. So that's this bit here. And we call it a penguin because this is what we call a penguin diagram. And there's a way that you can draw this that makes it look a bit like a penguin, but I think that's a little bit far-fetched. But I'm going to call it that anyway. Now, if we compare with what we had before, we've got this BCB and VCS here. Now we've got a loop, and primarily you get top quarks in these loops. So we've got VTB and VTS, and then the exact same mixing diagram here. So what we have now is nearly complete cancellation of these elements that end up in these diagrams. So this CP violating phase, which is phi S bar S, we've got rid of the charm, is approximately zero in the standard model. This makes it an excellent probe beyond standard model physics, because any non-zero CP violation here would be resulting from beyond standard model. So both of these things are what we call mixing-induced CP violation. You can have CP violation in decay, where you measure directly the rates of different processes. For example, if you have a B plus and then a B minus, But this is known as indirect CP violation, where you start with some neutral meson M, which could decay to final state F, but it could mix to its anti-meson state before it then decays to F. So for these types of decays, what we need to do is a flavor tagged time-dependent analysis. So what does that mean? Flavor tagging is, depending on which experiment you're on, means different things. But in this context, I mean, was it a BS or a BS quark to start with? What was that B quark in there, a B quark or an anti-B quark? We have to do a time-dependent analysis here because this mixing is encoded in the decay time distributions. As the mesons evolve in time, that's when they swap between their different M or M bar. So in order to probe this CP violating phase, we need to know about flavor and we need to do it in a time-dependent way. The other thing with this is to get this phenomenon, you need for this final state F to be accessible to both M and M bar. So BS255 is just one example of a charmless B to BV decay where B needs a vector meson. So that this is a class of decays where you can have a decay of a B meson, any one of these, to a charm-free vector meson. So a vector meson, I think I've got it written on one of these slides, is it's got a spin one. So there are many of these combinations of decays. There's lots of ways you can make this up. There are quite a lot of charmless vector mesons here, like the phi, the k star, and the rho. This is their sort of quark composition, but I'm going to focus on my favorite ones, and that is BS255 and B0255. So in BS255, we're looking at measuring CP violation and measuring this polarization puzzle that I hinted at earlier. And B0255, we want to measure its branching fraction. It's not been observed yet. And its branching fraction is actually sensitive to new physics. And then also, if you can study this, you have a chance of being able to constrain problems with BS255. This is the fully hadronic mode. There's no leptons in there. And these modes are particularly difficult for theorists to make predictions of the properties. So if you can understand these together, you might be able to constrain some of those. So what does a BS or a B0255 decay look like? This is just a cartoon, not to scale. But we study these in the proton-proton collisions at the LHC, which I've demonstrated here. And then you get a B meson, either a BS or a B0. And one of the properties of these B mesons and B hadrons is that they have a relatively long lifetime. And so they have what we call a characteristic displaced vertex. So they travel further from the where they're created than any of the other particles, which helps us to identify them. If you've got a where at the point where they decay, that's further away from the interaction point than for most other things. So at this point, it will decay into these two phi mesons, which will then very quickly decay each into a pair of kaons each, a pair of charged kaons. So in the end, we're reconstructing these four kaon tracks. So we measure this with the LHCb experiment at CERN. So LHCb is maybe a little bit different to ATLAS and CMS, where you're maybe expecting a proton-proton collider, a 4π detector that would cover the full acceptance. LHCb is a bit unusual in that the collision point is actually here. Your proton-proton beams come together and you have your collision inside what we call our vertex locator. So this is where we measure exactly where the proton-proton collision happened and then also where our B meson may have decayed. This is a tracking detector. We then also, further along, we have our particles typically coming this way in the sort of forward direction. And this is because the B quarks from proton-proton collisions are typically produced very forward. So after this, we have our rich detectors, ring imaging Cherenkov detectors. So as the particles pass through, they will generate these Cherenkov rings, which help us identify with a momentum measurement what that particle was. So it can distinguish pions, kaons, protons. Then we have our T stations. So these are another tracker. So we measure the trajectory of the particles through there, and then we get a measurement of its momentum. We have another rich detector, which targets a slightly different momentum range. And then we have calorimeters, which then measure the particle energies as they've sort of come to the very back. And muons in any of these decays, any of these proton-proton collisions, if we get muons, they can traverse the whole detector without sort of interacting. So they're picked up right at the back in what we call our muon stations. So you might be thinking, okay, why is this good for looking at these BS5 bifurcates specifically? So if we go back to the beginning with this vertex locator, as I said, we can identify these B mesons by using the fact that they have this displaced vertex. So by looking at the tracks in the vertex locator, if it's traveled a certain distance or is quite far away from the interaction point, we know that that was a B meson. The rich detectors are needed to identify those kaons in the final state as kaons. So we know that we haven't picked up something that wasn't really this final state of four charged kaons. We need our T stations for measuring track momentum. We also use parts of the calorimeter information to trigger on these events. So obviously we collect an awful lot of data and we need to separate out the bits that we care about from the bits that we don't. And the muon stations are useful here because it allows us to reject any background that comes from muons. If a muon looks a little bit like a kaon at this point, then we can say, oh, well, if it was in here, then it's probably a muon and not a kaon. So now I've told you how we measure these things, how do we actually get the physics out of this? So, here we go. This is what I was looking for. So BS mesons, these are called pseudoscalar mesons. So they've got a total spin of zero and an odd parity. Now, phi mesons, or these vector mesons, have a total spin of one and an odd parity. And what this all boils down to is that in the end, you have three contributing amplitudes from different what we call helicity combinations. So we have CP odd amplitudes and CP even amplitudes. And this is because we can define this decay in what we call the helicity basis. So if we look here, we've got a diagram of the decay. So we've got a BS rest frame in the middle, and then the phi's back. And then if we look at this, we've got the kaons coming back to back. And what we do is we can measure the angles between the kaon and the direction of flight of the phi in the BMS frame, and these kaons, each of the phi decays forms a plane, and you measure the angle between the two planes. And that can allow you to describe these amplitudes and do so what we end up doing is a fit to these angles to extract that CP violating phase that I described earlier. So this is a little bit technical, but essentially you do this this fit to the angles. You calculate these angles when you've reconstructed your decay, and then you can fit for the, essentially, you can fit for the magnitude of these different amplitudes, the CP odd and CP even amplitudes, and also what comes out of this fit is the CP violating phase, phi S, SS phi S. So doing this fit, you get this value of the CP violating phase, which we're expecting to be zero. So this is the latest measurement of phi S, S, S bar S, and this is coming from LHCB Brum 2 data. So this is data that was collected from 2015 to 2018. So the way that this is done is we reconstruct those four kaons, we calculate their invariant mass when you combine them together, and we look for a peak at the mass of the BS, and that's how we know we had a BS to start with. So we use this fit to the mass to statistically subtract any background. So all the rest of these distributions in this red box are the BS to phi phi signal. And these are the distributions of the angles I was talking about just before. So this line shape, this fit to these angles, are what's used to actually extract that value of that CP violating phase. And this is a four-dimensional fit where you've got the three angles, and also the decay time. As I said, we need the decay time to be able to get out the encoding, that mixing of the two neutral mesons. So that's the more complicated way of probing CP violation in BS5-phi. It's quite a complicated measurement, but there's another way of probing beyond standard model CP violation in these decays, and this is using something called triple product asymmetries. So these angles that I defined earlier, there's a way that you can combine them. So you can make these variables u and v, where you take the sine and cosine of these angles, multiply them together, and these just give you a quantity that is t odd, so times odd. So if you believe CPT symmetry, the CPT theorem, then if you've got a non-zero t odd scalar triple product, that means you've got a non-zero CP asymmetry. So you calculate these asymmetries by basically counting. If you measure the angles and then calculate these numbers, If you have an asymmetry in these numbers, so if you've got more greater than zero than you have less than zero, then you've got a non-zero asymmetry. And this is zero in the standard model. And this would be a smoking gun for beyond standard model physics. Now, the benefit of doing a measurement like this is you just have to calculate the angles and then count how many events you have one side or the other of zero. So you don't have to do this complicated fit to the angles or the decay time. You essentially just count how many there are, but that doesn't give you access to this CP violating phase from the CKM matrix. The other thing I alluded to earlier is this thing called the polarization puzzle. So for B to B beta case, there are these three polarization amplitudes I mentioned earlier. So this is the CP odd and the CP even amplitudes. Now, one of these we call the longitudinal polarization. And because these decays are what we call helicity suppressed, we expect from theory that this longitudinal polarization should be very dominant. So one of these amplitudes should be close to one. Now, if you look in tree-level B2B decays, like the B2J-Sci-Fi that I showed earlier, that is the case, the longitudinal polarization does dominate. But if you then have these decays where your penguin level, there are sizable contributions from the other polarizations. And this is really not quite understood. We really do expect that they're going to be primarily this one amplitude, but we get quite a lot of the other amplitudes in these these loop level B2B beta case. So that's something that's a bit perplexing, not understood, and we're still trying to figure out. So here's a bit of history of these measurements. So I've shown you the LHV from 2 measurement, but actually this started at the Tevatron era at CDF. So this was a proton antiproton collider at Fermilab, where the first evidence for this VS-55 decay was seen, and then this also was the first measurement of this branching fraction, the polarization amplitudes, and the triple product asymmetry. Then moving on to LHC from 1, again, there's measurements of these triple product asymmetries, but it was the first time we were able to make measurements of this CP violating phase by S, and this was the first time we searched for B0 to phi phi as well. As we've gone through the years and LHCB has collected more data, we've updated our value of phi S again and again, and kept searching for this mode, B0 to phi phi. So this is a summary of the values of phi S, SS bar S so far. So we've got the first one at the bottom and then going more and more data, we're going up, but slowly but surely we're improving the value of phi S, SS bar S with more of this data, and so far it's consistent with the standard model. But what else can we probe? So I've hinted at this a lot, and that's searching for B0 to phi phi. So this has an even more complicated diagram that I've simplified to just showing you a dot. So this is an example of what we call a BD to SS bar annihilation. This is very, very suppressed in the standard model. So it's got Kamibo suppression. This means you've got quarks from different families swapping over. You're crossing over between multiple generations of the quarks. So that it adds a suppression. You get suppression from the fact that you've got loops in this Feynman diagram, and you've also got suppression from something called the OZ or OZI rule. Now, this rule is if you can draw a Feynman diagram where at any point in time you only have gluons, so you could cut the gluon lines and have two disconnected diagrams, that is a suppressed mode. So this mode, B0 to 5 has all of these things, so it's really not looking good for having many of those. However, the branching fraction can be enhanced in a few scenarios. So we might get more than these than we're expecting if we have something like R parity violating supersymmetry. So this is just a model of supersymmetry. Models of omega phi mixing. So omega is another one of these mesons, and it's possible that the omega and the phi can mix in the same way that neutral B mesons can. And if that's possible, then that can enhance this branching fraction. The other thing is rescattering. So if it decays into something and then the final state particles rescatter to give you the same final state as B0 to phi phi, that can also enhance the process. So there's a lot of interesting things that we could probe by looking at how often this process occurs. Now, the problem is the theory predictions for these branching fractions are very different and vary by up to an order of magnitude. So that's shown in this plot on the right. So we've got the branching fraction in times 10 to the minus 8. Along the bottom, and this blue point here is at about 0.2, 0.3, and then this point over here is more than 4. So there's quite a big range of predictions for this. They vary depending on how they were calculated, for example. And also they are quite difficult to calculate, but let's see if LHCB has anything to say on this. So the previous best limit from LHCB was data from up to 2016 and set a limit 2.7 times 10 to the minus 8. So that's this pink region towards the right. So how do you search for a mode like this at LHCB? So as I said before, these fines decay into two charged kaons. So that's a nice final state to reconstruct their charge track. So they do trajectory in our trackers, and our rich detectors are able to identify those kaons quite cleanly. So what we do is we reconstruct these kaons. We reconstruct this fine, and we require that the fine mesons under four kaons are consistent with coming from an identified B. And what you need to do is look for the B0 to 5.5 by looking for a significant peak at the B0 mass when you calculate the invariant mass of those four kaons. So this is in this sketch on the right. So if you get all of the data from LHCB and you find pairs of four kaons, you would expect a peak at the BS mass where you've got BS to 5.5. This has a branching fraction at about 10 to the minus 5. And then you'd also have one at B0 to, at the B0 mass with a branching fraction of who knows. Now, this looks quite nice and straightforward, and in a perfect world, this is what we would have. But it's not so simple in reality, and that's because we have lots of backgrounds that can limit how sensitive you are for looking for these things. We can't do everything perfectly. So you get events in this distribution. You're not just going to have these two peaks. You're going to have events coming from lots of different things that are not signal, but look sufficiently like the signal that it passes your selections. So one of these things is misidentified backgrounds. If a particle is given the wrong label so that it looks like you've got four kaons, but you didn't really, you might have had three kaons and a pion, three kaons and a proton. Combinatorial background, this is where you've just shoved four kaons together and hoped the best, and it doesn't actually come from anything in particular. You've just found four kaons that look like they could have come from a B. And then also you get partially reconstructed background. So you might have had four real kaons and then missed something else. Another background is the BS to 5.5 itself. And BS to 5.5 is what we call our normalization mode. It's the sort of benchmark that we can compare any B0 signal to. So why is that a background? Well, it's because that there's a limited precision on the momentum. So when we calculate the invariant mass of these four kaons, these peaks are spread out by the fact that we don't know the momentum perfectly well. And this means that the B0 to 5.5 distribution and the BS to 5.5 distribution overlap. So we want to limit this overlap as much as possible to allow us to have more sensitivity to any peak that is at the B0 mass. And the main culprit for this are actually, if you have a kaon from BS to 5.5 that has a decay in flight or it interacts hadronically within the detector, that gives you a really poor momentum reconstruction. So I'm going to call these kaon interactions. That means interaction, hadronic interaction or a decay in flight, but not having to write that every time. So at the top, we've got a cartoon of a kaon that hasn't interacted. It's got a nice straight track. You can see where it came from. You can see where it's going, and you can measure its momentum. But if something happened here, some sort of kaon interaction, you end up with a kinked track. It's not continuous. It's got a sort of break in it. And if this happens before the trajectory has been measured in our tracking stations, you get a poorer track reconstruction, and as a result, a poorer momentum measurement, which then has its impact on the B mass. So this is seen again here. So you can imagine this is a kaon that's got a nice trajectory through the trackers. We've got hits in all of these trackers that we can join together. It, obviously, this is a bit, we don't actually join the dots. There's a complicated bit that goes into this. But essentially, what we see is these series of hits to the detector, but the track reconstruction doesn't know that the track was bent or kinked. So it does a pretty poor job of reconstructing what the initial momentum of that kaon was. So this is a problem. So what I'm showing here is this is LHCB simulation, where I've on the left, I've decided let's only look at the invariant mass distribution where we've got kaons that have stayed completely intact the whole way through. And this is a nice narrow peak. It's got a RMS value of about 18.5. Now, if we compare this to the plot on the right, so the y scale is truncated because there are fewer of these, but the x-axis is exactly the same range. This is where I've said, of those four kaons, if at least one of them has had one of these hadronic interactions or decays in flight, show me what the invariant mass of that looks like. And this is very broad with large tails. It's got an RMS of nearly 80. So to show you where the B0 mass is, it's about here. So you can see we've got a lot of events from BS55, where you've got these dodgy kaons populating here. Now, I showed you on the previous plot, the branching fraction for BS55 is at the level of 10 to the minus 5. So if we expect that the B0 to 55 is at 10 to the minus 8, you don't have to have very many of these for this to completely swarm any signal that you have. So how do we deal with this? Well, at the time that I was doing it, the option is to remove them. And the way we did that is training a boosted decision tree classifier. So this is a machine learning technique. And this classifier was able to distinguish those interactive kaons from the stable ones, despite the fact that we don't know anything more than sort of really where the hits were in the tracker. So this BDT was trained on some discriminating variables, and these variables that are good at telling these types of kaons apart are the quality of the track fit. So if the track had a poor fit, a poor chi-squared, that's an indication that it had one of these events. How likely it is that the track is a ghost. So a ghost track is where you randomly combine hits in the tracker because they look like they could be a trajectory. So it turns out that it looks more like a ghost if it's had one of these interactions. The number of hits that the track leaves in the tracker is actually useful for separating these things, and also the kinematics of the track. So what its momentum was and its pseudo-rapidity. So pseudo-rapidity is essentially a measure of how close it is to the beam line. So I trained this classifier, and there's a lot of plots on here, so I'm going to go step by step. So on the left, we've got the response of this classifier. So what happens is you give this classifier your data, and you say, give it a score based on how likely you think it is to have been stable or not stable. So you get a value between 1 and minus 1, where 1 is, I think this kaon was perfect, and minus 1 is, I have no doubt in my mind that this was a terrible kaon. So you can see in this inset plot where we've got these red and blue distributions. So this was trained on simulation. So we know that the events in blue were the ones that had an interaction, and we know that the events in red did not. And you can see that this classifier gives really good separation. So the non-interactive kaons are peaked at 1, and the interactive ones peaked at minus 1. Perfect. It's got really good separation between these two things. The other thing we want to check is, because we don't know that it's done this in data, because we don't have the true information that we have in simulation, we want to check that does this classifier do what we expect it to on real data. And the way we do that is we look at B-cluster j-psi k-cluster k's, and we look at when a j-psi decays, it primarily decays to a pair of muons. Now, I looked at what this classifier did when you gave it a muon. So as I told you before, these muons make it all the way to the end of LHCb. We collect them in the muon stations. They shouldn't have a kinked track or a bent track because they make it all the way through. And that's exactly what we see here. We see that so this is actually truncated at the cut point, but believe me when I say there weren't any at minus one. And the other thing we want to check is this behaves in the same way whether you look at the real data or the simulation. So the classifier works pretty much consistently regardless of whether it's simulated data or real data. So that's great. We can separate these interactive kaons from the non-interactive ones. Now, if we look at this plot on the right, this is again the BS55 invariant mass distribution in simulation. So what I was doing before is I was looking at the simulation, the information there to decide which ones were interactive and which ones weren't. Now I'm just requiring that we have this score greater than minus 0.4, I think it is where I picked it. So if you apply this classifier, you see that the distribution, we've got the dark pink is after the requirement and the light pink is before. So you can see this bit here, which is where the B0 mass, this tail is reduced hugely, which is exactly where we want to be most sensitive. So that's great. That's fantastic. But that wasn't the only background. As I mentioned before, we have these combinatorial backgrounds. This is where you get randomly combined tracks to form a final state of four kaons. But some combinatorial is less random than others. So something that we get a lot of in these proton-proton collisions, especially at LHCb, is DS meson. So this is a charm and an anti-strange, or the other way around. And we get these both prompt, so actually in the proton-proton collision itself, and also in the decays from BS. So BS decays to DS quite a lot. So that means we get tons of these DS plus mesons. So it turns out that when a DS plus decays, about 15% of the time, it has a phi in the decay. So the question is were we combining phi mesons that were actually coming from DS, because we have so many of them that it's really likely that we get two independent phi mesons in an event? And it turns out the answer is yes. So we can check for these in a data-driven way. So we take our BS to phi phi data. So this is the data that we've selected as being consistent with being a BS to phi phi decay. And we look at the side bands of the data. So away from where the peak is, where it just looks like junk, we take that data set. And then we take one of the mesons, the phi mesons from there, and we look and see if there was another track nearby. So in this case, we look for a charged pion.
So that side bands are the BS mass.
Yeah, so it would be here onwards, sort of from maybe 500 this way, because we know that this actual signal isn't there. So we take that sideband data, we take one of the phi mesons, we look to see if there was a charge pion, and then what we do is we calculate the invariant mass of the two pions plus the pion, because that would give you the DS mass if it really truly came from a DS. And if you look at this sample, okay, there's a lot of combinatorial background there as well, because this isn't all of it, but there's a very, very clear peak at the DS mass. So a lot of this event in our BS55 data that we'd already selected, we've got a very clear signal for this particular background. So one thing I will say as well is this is just the case where we look for a pion. There are lots of other options where you can get a DS to a phi something else. And a lot of those cases we have a neutrino in it, which we can't reconstruct, and therefore we can't get this neat peak. So doing this method, we can only really get the ones with a charge pion. So what would you know? I've trained another BDT, so I can identify these as well. So what we do is we can veto the ones where there was a pion. We knew it had a massive DS mass. But then we can also use those events to train another classifier. We presumed that a lot of the properties of those events would be very similar to the ones where we couldn't reconstruct that extra track and reconstruct the mass properly. So we trained a BDT that would target any event that looked like it was consistent with a DS decaying to a phi and then you missing that extra track. Now, so we've got a classifier that can get rid of those, and then we also chuck away the ones that we know for sure were gone. But that's not all of the combinatorial. You can get 4 kaons from lots of different places. And so we also trained another MVA that targets those more general combinatorial backgrounds. And it turns out that if you do this sort of staged approach where you're targeting slightly different criteria, you get a much better reduction of the background by targeting them separately instead of trying to get them all in one go. And when we sort of worked out what requirements we should place on these classifiers, we did this optimization altogether. So we used particle identification variables, which come from the rich, and we used these two classifiers, and we optimized that selection in a sort of multi-dimensional way to ensure that we got the best sensitivity we could using a combination of techniques. Now, the very last backgrounds we've got are what I call these mis-ID backgrounds. So this is where we could think we've got 4 kaons, but we didn't really. So one of these is decays of lambda b. So lambda b is a b baryon, and most it can decay into a proton, a charged kaon, and a phi, where that phi is again 2 charged kaons. So this is 3 charged kaons and a proton. But sometimes that proton gets misidentified as a kaon, and you can see how this can sort of very quickly look like what we're looking for. But you can get rid of this, because if you calculate this invariant mass where you think this one was a kaon, if you require that mass is close to the phi mass, which is what we actually want in our signal, then we get rid of most of this. So that's good. The other one is B0 to phi K star. This is another interesting decay, because it's another one of these charmless B to BB decays. But I don't care about these ones, so I'm going to throw them away. And what we have here is we've got three cartons and then a pion. And this one's a little bit trickier to get rid of, but essentially you look at the invariant mass of the K and the pi. You give the track that looks most like a pion. You say, okay, let's pretend this one's the pion. Look at the invariant mass. If it's close to the K star mass, we'll get rid of it. And then we also look at the, if we pretend that the one that's most pion-like is a pion, we'll get calculate that invariant mass. If that's close to the B0 mass, then we'll just tighten our selections a bit more on those ones. And that gets rid of a lot of this as well. So that's a lot of studying what could be going wrong, getting rid of the stuff that we don't want. So we've developed these selections to clean up the data as much as possible while also retaining the signal as much as possible. And like I say, I optimize this using what's called a Punzi figure of merit, which optimizes for your signal significance. After you've done that, you then model what contributions are left over. You model what the shapes look like in the invariant mass distribution. We get yields of the background, we get estimates of the background yields using both data-driven methods and also using the simulation. And then right at the end, we're fitting our data to the 4K invariant mass distribution and looking for that peak of the B0 mass. So when I show you this, it's split into two plots. And the reason for that is that there are differences in the data taking conditions between run one and run two in LHCb. So the shapes are very slightly different. So we fit them simultaneously. So the yield of our signal is something that's shared in both of the fits, but we have the data split up for better sensitivity. So these are the final fits after all of that work. This is also a log plot. I wish I put it in the backup, but I forgot. There are plots of the linear scale, and you can see just how much background we got rid of. It's very, very small. So what we've got here is this big blue peak is the BS5pi signal, where we've got like very good control over these tails. These shaded regions are all these various backgrounds. So this sort of big purple shoulder is lambda B. We've got this sort of more bluey coloured one peaking right in the middle. That's the B0 to 5K star. And then we've got this partially reconstructed stuff at lower masses. And then this sort of gold yellow peak is the fitted value of the B0 to 5K signal. So in the end, in run one, there's 2.6 plus or minus 1.5. And in run two, 10.5 plus or minus 6.3, which is a significance of 1.9 sigma, which means we did not find anything. But all is not lost, because we've got actually the new best upper limit on searching for this mode. So we do this using what's called the CLS method, which is the statistical method to tell you what the sort of 90 and 95% limit on your branching fraction is based on what you saw and also what you would expect in a null test. And we set our limit at 1.3 times 10 to the minus 8 at 90% confidence level. So this plot on the right shows you, it was the same plot we had before, but with my new limit. And you can see that quite a lot of these are getting sort of slowly but surely ruled out. So I think this one's probably wrong, actually. But this improved, this limit is improved by a factor of 2 on the previous LHCb limit. Now, you expect that the expected limit, so this, the actual limit comes from this solid line. This is what we actually saw in the data. But the expected limit, that's this dashed line. That's what we expected based on if we sort of saw nothing. And where that dashed line is actually improved by a factor of 2.5 on the previous analysis, because we've got an upward fluctuation. Now, that expected limit improving by a factor of 2.5, you get a factor of 1.4 from increased statistics. We used extra bits of the data set. As I said, the first one was up to 2016. We've included data from 2017 and 2018. So that's a factor of 1.4. But that means we get a factor of 1.8 improvement from doing all of this stuff with the BDTs. So we haven't just added more data. We've been smarter about what the background is to really push it even further to the point where we might like to see what on earth the value actually is. So that was a really nice result. So what's coming next? I think it's safe to say I've squeezed everything that I could out of run one and run two. But luckily for us, LHCb run three has collected a record amount of data. It's really incredible. So this plot on the right is our recorded integrated luminosity, so how much data we collected. This is run one, this is run two, and then this is run three. We've got a total of 37 inverse femtobars. The result I just showed you was with 9. Now, BS255 and other hadronic modes benefit in an additional way. And that is because when we upgraded our detector to do run three, so when we collected all this data, not only are we collecting more data, we've also upgraded our trigger solution so that it's fully software. Now, what this means is before we had very harsh momentum cuts from our hardware trigger, and they are gone. And now we have an efficiency on these hadronic modes that is improved by up to a factor of two per inverse femtobarb. So not only do we have more inverse femtobarb, we're also getting twice as much in each of those inverse femtobarbs as we were before. So more data, more BS255 per data. And so if you assume similar performance as run one and run two, you get a really good sensitivity on this phi S phase. So 23 millibands is the sensitivity that we might gain. And run one and run two, it was 69. So this is a huge improvement. This slide's a bit sad, actually, because on the Monday, I found out that actually we're not getting it from this from the UK, but that's fine. We'll go on anyway. But let's be optimistic. LHCb is going to be upgraded again before the High Luminosity LHC project for LHCb upgrade 2. So this upgrade is designed to fully exploit that high luminosity LHC to get as much data as we can. So if you look at the previous slide, like this looks like insane gains in our data taking, but that is just this little blob here. It looks minuscule compared to what we could have with LHCb upgrade 2. To do this, LHCb needs to be able to cope with the large number of interactions happening per bunch crossing. These events are highly really messy. And you can see this in this plot on the bottom. So this is the VELO, our vertex locator. So on the left, this is a proton-proton interaction in this sort of, this is just one proton-proton collision. I mean, I don't know about you, but I would have absolutely no hope of disentangling what's going on in here. But if you add timing to the VELO, and you can look at this in a 20 picosecond window, all of a sudden this becomes much more manageable. So if you do introduce timing to the detectors to do hand wavily a 4D reconstruction, it means that we could collect a data set up to 300 inverse femtobarbs, which would give us the statistics to really to see a really good measurement of these things and you know potentially say something about the understanding model physics. So I think that's me, pretty much perfectly on time. Brilliant. So hopefully I've convinced you that there's a lot of interesting things you can study with these B2BB decays. I just showed you B0 and BS255, but of course if you swap the phis for something else, you get even more interesting physics there. So these B2BB decays, especially in upgrade one, so run three of LHCb, these are really one to watch. The BS and B0255 decays provide these excellent tests of the standard model, so non-zero phis, non-zero triple product asymmetry. These are a smoking gun for the understanding of model physics. And also there's something really curious going on with this polarization puzzle that's not fully understood. The branching fraction of this B0 to 5-5 mode is enhanced in many scenarios, and it's very complex, and it puts theory really to the test. And LHCb might be one of these cases where LHCb can say something first. But all of these measurements are limited by those statistics. These are rare modes, and we don't have the huge data sets, but we didn't, and now we're getting more. But that means that these modes really target for the upcoming LHCb upgrades, because getting more data will get you better measurements. And if B0 to 5-5, if branching fraction is at the lower end of those theory predictions, we really might be able to see it in run three. So stay tuned.
Thank you very much, Mary. Very nice talk. So let's have some questions. Yes.
So I realize I'm a bit ignorant about phis, but if you were looking for a decay that involved D, you'd be worried about a D star emitting a pi zero and decaying to a D and wins the pi zero. Is there no case where a BS would go to a phi in an excited phi state and then you lose a pi zero?
Oh,
so that would reflect into roughly your region.
So, I mean, it would be at the lower masses. I actually don't know what that would be. a sort of the excited by say. I think I'm sort of
must be able to go to higher end.
There must be. So I think these probably these will have been accounted for when we studied the case to sort of other sort of light, what we call light on flavored vector mesons. And you essentially look at what they look like if you miss that pion, and they sort of really get pushed to these lower these lower.
Maybe it's time too far left to worry, haven't
it? Sorry?
Maybe it's time too far left to worry.
I think so. I think, and there are probably, I'm trying to imagine, I think there are probably other cuts that might get that as well. Like if you, like requiring that they're consistent with coming from, if you miss, I guess if you miss, no, I suppose if you've got, I'm trying to imagine if you've got the file, it might not point back quite right as well. So that, I imagine that would probably catch it as well. But yeah, you're right. I mean, in principle, any of these things where you miss a track and you've still got something that's consistent with the phi. And the other problem with the phi is it's what we call close to threshold. So those two kaons are, the invariant mass of the two kaons is very close to the breadth mass of the phi. So you don't get very much of an opening angle when they decay. So the vertex of the decay vertex of the phi, or, well, I suppose it decays strongly, so it's basically the same thing, but you don't get very good pointing back to that anyway. So there are things we have to do to deal with that that will probably maybe capture as well.
So are you saying a state where you could have two phis, but one of the phis a higher resonance phi decaying down to a phi?
Yeah, that's what I was wondering about.
But then I guess wouldn't that also have a really low branch? The Feynman diagram would be the same, right? So the branch fraction.
No, that's BS. And the BS is
a phi sometimes. I see what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, you're right. That's something that we would reconstruct as having four kaons that would be consistent with having a B. So yeah, I think it would be. I'd have to check, but yeah, it would be quite that and probably captured by all of the selections that look for similar topologies.
I still think you'd probably have moves quite a lot branching fraction.
I think so. I would have to look at what it was. Yeah.
So you had a specific rejection of the S plus peak, but you also showed a D0 plus peak in the same plot, and you didn't mention it. I mean, it looked like it was almost as, not almost as big, but.
Yeah, so that's just another D meson. So,
but why not remove those as well?
Well, we do. I think the method is pretty agnostic as to what that was. The reason I've sort of explained it in the way that I have is because they're the sort of most clear example of where you've got something, you get more DS from BS. But yeah, there's no reason, the properties don't rely on
the approach will catch both.
Exactly, yeah. So that peak is just used to select a clean signal that you can then use to train the NVA that catches the other ones. So it has to be sort of agnostic of mass and kit, otherwise you bias things. So it catches those other ones as well.
The first BDT you talked about was for catching the king's tracks, having like interactions. Okay. Looked like it worked really well, but I was kind of surprised you didn't use the phi peak as a, you know, you could tighten your cuts on the fine ass to check that the kaon was correctly constructed.
So the phi, so yes, and this is something that we sort of discussed, but it doesn't really help you so much. So the phi is a broader resonance as itself. It depends who you ask whether or not phi is a broad resonance, actually. If you ask a theorist, it's a very narrow resonance, but it's actually broad enough that the phi itself has a width that's at the same level as the momentum, and you sort of get momentum effects and actual width effects. So, I mean, one of the things that we thought about was fitting the phi mass as well, but because you get, it just doesn't help you really.
I guess maybe it's close to threshold with the kaon.
Yeah, and as well, we make quite tight cuts on that mass window anyway. But yeah, it doesn't help you, fortunately. But it helps for other things. So.
Yeah, this is coming from someone who's really unfamiliar with finding that seat about. Especially going into the sort of high stats here at iLumi, are there any areas where you like heavily rely on simulation? So specific models where sort of changing that model might massively change the result, similar to the sort of issues we're dealing with going into high stats in Neutrino analyses where you know you switch a model out in simulation, your result can change massively, and we're really worried about that going forward. So do you see any of that in the sort of LHP analyses?
I mean, we do see these things in LHP analyses a lot, of, especially, I mean, these ones will always be statistically limited, I think.
Yeah.
And especially in these searches, like you basically don't really rely on simulation being a specific decay model or whatever for that. I think, and 5.5, the sort of CKMN, like with it being very close to zero, like, I think as well, that's not super reliable. But like I said, they will probably always be statistically limited. But we do see this in LHCB, right? Like you have these very high stats charm modes, like we get tons of charm. And a lot of those are having to do basically data-driven everything. And because you just can't generate enough, like even just generating enough simulation, like you've got bigger samples of data than you could ever hope to have simulated anyway. So yeah, indeed we have sort of problems with some modes. But then, I mean, you're right as well in sort of the model that you use for the decay. I mean, these always come into systematics with these analyses. So you might generate simulation under a different decay model with different sort of hypothesis about what your CP violation is, how they decay, the amplitude, things like that. So, but they would come into sort of doing systematics check. But yeah, for this B0 to 5.5, not at all. BS to 5.5, it definitely comes into a systematic, but then it's statistically. But good question.
Not a physics, more of a data. So when the proton interact and we get a lot of track, how do you detect the angle, the triangle, using the machine learning or through for the construction?
So you mean the sort of the angles that we use to calculate the CP violation thing when I showed the sort of planes?
Yes, I mean, we have huge amount of data.
Yeah, so that will be, they're calculated from, you know, the trajectories of the tracks. So you measure where the tracks went, and then you sort of reconstruct them back, and then calculate the angles in between the vectors and things. So because you have, I mean, you get a lot of background as well that you try and reduce as best you can, but when you know you've got a pure signal, you just use the tracks that you reconstructed to sort of work back and sort of work out where that vertex was and what the angles between them were at the point that they were produced.
I don't even know what the question is, but I noticed on page 26. We go back there.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, okay. Yeah,
right. The Feynman diagram, you talk about the OZZI suppression, but if I wanted to fill in something on for that dot, I would start with a loop of two parts and two W's.
Yeah, have I got this in the back of? That's not it. No. Okay, so I haven't got it, but you end up with, let's get back. So you have, you end up with a top loop, and then the top radiates another gluon. So you have this gluon coming from here, but then, no, it's not a top.
It's BD bar. So it's got some bar number that's got to carry through, or a W.
Yeah.
But maybe the same thing applies if you have a W there as well as a glue.
Yeah, you have the W's for the layer changing, and then there's a, yes, you have the W's, and then they have top loops in them, and then it's the tops that are radiating the glue ons, and then the glue ons are, it's just the glue ons, and then you get the SS bar, and then there's a sort of consideration of color, but I can't remember the argument for why just having, there's a reason why you shouldn't have just two glue ons, but it's fine in this. I'd have to look at
Yeah, the BG have the different color, then you take the glue on off, so yeah, you can't really have the same color combined.
Yeah. It's in my thesis, but I should
Ah,
put it
yeah, so
in the backup.
that's probably what pushes it to be.
I've remembered it now. So you have the W sort of coming back down, and then you have
You
the
could
B,
draw it, but
the W.
draw
Okay.
the skips.
Is it this one? So you have, pretty sure you have something like, then that is something like that. So you get this sort of layer changing at the top, radiating the blue ones, and then the blue ones going to SS bar.
Okay, makes sense. Thank
Um,
you.
but
Yeah,
yeah,
that's much simpler. I was thinking. Yeah, okay.
it's just a bit gross. And all the theorists sort of look at it like this, because you've got, because you sort of look at whether you can sort of factorize the diagrams or not, and essentially that you end up with, if you forget about the quarks, you end up with these diagrams being kind of all the corrections to the BS version as well, which is why this, if you actually saw this and could marry some theory prediction with what you've observed, you might then have a better idea of what these higher order corrections in BS 5.5 were doing. I mean, if we saw a sort of a large enhancement from the CP violation, for example, like there'd probably be some consideration for whether that's theory effect that's been missed off, and then this would then become useful to understand if that higher order correction would do that. Good.
Okay, so shall we close? If I got if there are no more questions, I think we can thank Mary again. We're going to lunch. Please join us if you're online. Thank you. Thank you. On Zoom, we have some.